Well, I was thinking about what I might touch on today, and I find myself really inclined toward the fundamentals, or, you know, how did this practice that we're all doing come about initially? Like, what was it coming out of? And, you know, Indian Buddhism is very complex, very complex. And anyone that's studied some of the sutras or even any of the Theravadin practices and all the, you know, signs of insight and so on, it's quite involved. And then from India, when it went into Tibet, it got even more complex because the Tibetan culture had this kind of a shamanic tradition, lots of good spirits and bad spirits and deity practice, and also a very profound development of subtle yoga, working with the energy centers of the body and so on. So that practice is also quite complicated. Then what was in China at the time of Bodhidharma, that, you know, anyone that knows this in detail is going to say, but Jeff, you got the dates all wrong. But no, I just, again, this is my simple-minded understanding, but you might say Sutra Buddhism, the beginning, the history and the ethics and kind of the monastic tradition that, again, was not really suited to householders necessarily, but the householders' part in that tradition was to support the monasteries, in order to gain merit. And it was pretty much the same in India as well. That was the access that people had to Dharma, was to, you know, feed the monks and in some way support the monastic setting where the real training took place. Then China went into a period of like complete collapse and disaster. As I understand it, 2/3 of the population died off. There was civil war, and there was all kinds of, you know, different factions fighting back and forth. The whole society collapsed. And in the midst of that is where Zen began to emerge, a mix of, you might say, the practicalities of actually gaining Shakyamuni Buddha's experience for ourselves, that kind of ethic, mixed with Taoism, which is very connected to nature and the natural order of the universe. So they were a nice, friendly mix in China. So also in that period, you know, Bodhidharma showed up. Apparently, red hair, wild-eyed. And we all know the story of how, you know, when he went before the emperor and said, you know, and the emperor asked him, you know, I've supported all these monasteries. I've created all this merit. You know, how much is my merit? And Bodhidharma said, you know, no merit. No, nothing. And then there was another question. What was the other one? Sort of like, you know, so what is the essence of your teaching? Or, no, who are you?
Who are you?
Yeah, that's right. Who are you? Yeah. And that's where we get our don't know. You know, he said, don't know. And then he went off and faced a wall in the cave at Shaolin for 9 years. That's what he did. So there's a real emphasis on doing it in Zen, Chan, Chan, you know, it was in China, it was Chan. And it came from China to Korea and Japan. But there was a big emphasis on doing it, engaging with it, actually working with our crazy minds and working directly in a way of sitting down and just being with ourselves in a very attentive way. Notice what it is to be human. What it is. Why is it so troubling? What, you know, why is it such a struggle? And, you know, it's, that goes all the way back to Shakyamuni. Remember, he was, you know, a prince, everything was set, he had a beautiful wife and a child, and encountered, you know, one day a sick man, I think a corpse, a dead man, realized it doesn't turn out that well, necessarily. I've been living in this illusion. And I think we all do that now. How many of us really consider on a day-to-day, you know, might say kind of, yeah, day-to-day basis, there's a time limit on this. You know, the clock is ticking and it doesn't end up in any kind of reassuring way. It's kind of alarming when we're so involved in establishing ourselves and finding our way and having satisfaction and, you know, beauty in life to realize, well, it all kind of, what's it all come to? It's all about, this isn't going to last. So that impermanence. And so then what did Buddha do? A lot like Bodhidharma. You know, he's sort of a model, you might say. He went and sat under a tree. You know, under the Bodhi tree. 6 years. He just sat down. I mean, he tried asceticism, he tried some of these extreme practices. He was very familiar with the Hindu culture and all of the complexities of that, but it just came around to just sitting himself down and being still and seeing what is there, what is this? No? That's our sort of fundamental calm. What is this? Or what am I? So, you know, this whole program of Dharma began in a very simple way, became extremely complex and convoluted, and had many different branches and lots of study and methods, complex methods of, you know, basically finding out, what am I, what is this? And that's what we've inherited here. We spend a lot of time sitting. The chanting is, you know, kind of fun, energizing and good, but it comes around to nothing much to do, sitting here, and, you know, and this is running. And our legs hurt, and, you know, it's not easy. It's actually not easy, particularly in our society, or you know, very natural for people to just sit down and do nothing. Not at all. Because we've got this. We've got this all. It's amazing. We've got airport. I couldn't believe it coming up here, you know. Like, all these people, every person, almost every person to a person, like not even, yeah, everyone has, they're just, they're absorbed in this. That's a kind of a new phenomenon. But isn't it interesting that we cannot just sit down with ourselves without entertainment of some kind, or, you know, the latest communication with someone or to someone, or, you know, all that. The mind, we have this hungry dog mind, you could say, kind of like a hungry dog, always looking for food. Feed the mind. Keep this, you know, questioning, intellect, kind of finding our way, making sense. Maybe sometimes in a more strategic way, you know, getting well educated, finding a good career, finding the right mate, then give up, find another right mate. But we're kind of driven. That's sort of, it's in our nature to be driven in that way. And this monkey mind is so hungry for stimulation. And what do? We sit down. I mean, the floor is kind of interesting. but it's just sitting still and being with this very moment, just this very moment, fundamentally. And it turns out, if we're willing to, you know, have some of these qualities that come along, to be, number one, to kind of be patient with ourselves, be patient. And something I really happened upon yesterday, because my mind was just going crazy. I just got into a really dark place and angry, and I've got all kinds of reasons why things aren't the way I want them to be. It went on and on and on. I was just torturing myself with all this. It was just kept going. And then I realized, I'm really hard on myself. I mean, I really expect a lot of myself. And where'd that come from? I think it's cultural. There's a high bar here in America. And also, you know, throughout most of the world, it's a high bar for a meaningful life. It's meaningful if I achieve a lot, or if I, you know, really strive or push. And so then I got involved in Zen, and you just sit down and do nothing. And, well, we have the koan curriculum, and there's a sense of progressing there, we could say, maybe. We get hooked into that, sort of, well, pass another one, and pass another one, or I didn't, I can't pass those, and there's so many, and it's more that hungry dog mind. We don't want to, you know, feed that hungry dog. We don't want to encourage the hungry dog mind. So one thing is about working, you know, in interviews and stuff, and it's so lovely, really, I gotta say, you know, meeting each one of you, having a little time, and you're all so generous and honest and, you know, willing to, you know, kind of unmask and let's find out what's useful for you. It's something I've been talking with people today, yesterday too. So if we approach our koan practice that way, of some kind of urgency, or, you know, if only I could get through this one, I'm stuck on this, you know. We kind of set this, a goal or a bar for ourselves. And that, I think Eric would agree, is sort of like the least useful strategy in koan training. But we're so used to striving and being hungry for achievement and finding our way. And if we're committed to Zen training, I mean, that's a big piece of it, it seems. What fundamentally comes from working through with koans? What fundamentally comes? I'm asking for someone to respond. What would you say? What comes from that? Besides frustration and maybe anxiety going on down to the interview room, I don't know. But what comes from engaging with it in a, you know, year after year as we do?
Well, there's an openness that comes from that.
Let's just say an openness?
Yes.
So say a little more about that. I think that's a very good answer. Yeah.
As you know, I've basically been involved in retraining myself in programming, and I've talked to some of the people who were, you know, because I went an alumnus and I was a teaching assistant, I was talking to someone who was going through the program I'd just been through, and I said, you know, you don't imagine that you're going to get to a point where you say, I get it. You just get used to not getting it. And that's really what I've gotten from koan practice, is being used to where you don't get it.
Right.
It's okay.
It's okay.
Yes.
Now that's a hard one, okay. That is. That's a hard one, okay. That's like some sense of, you know, kindness towards yourself. I'm making effort. I'm applying myself as, you know, as I've been instructed, as I've found my way. And it's okay. It's okay that I don't, you know, I don't totally get it. So that's one. Yes, Eric.
It's very similar to what Lux said, but another way of looking at it, and I think it's really helpful, is we're familiarizing ourselves with not knowing. This don't know mind, which we talk about, is by definition given to us each time we go for an interview. And it's uncomfortable because we're used to leaning on something, our ideas and things like that. But we were talking about becoming familiar with aspect of mind that you don't encounter day to day, just walking down the street. And if people could see the value in that, I think over time, some people do and some people never do, but I think it's really important.
What is it that's really important?
Recognizing when you go into an interview, you get don't know.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And our ego doesn't like that because we want to get it. But as Lex said, it's opening.
Yeah.
It's opening ourselves up to not having something in an open and shut case, which is the way the world works.
Yeah. We're kind of going upstream a lot, you know. But what is that wonderful book, Joko Beck, Don't Push the River? Don't Push the River.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah.
So I think a good deal of the struggle, if we feel there's a flavor of struggle with our koan work, is self-created. It's not designed to be a struggle. It is a very just fiendishly brilliant invitation into not knowing. It's a fiendishly brilliant invitation. You can take it like that. And when we rest with don't know, we become a little more familiar with the intelligence prior to thought. That's one thing I say. Intelligence prior to thought. Sort of like, you could say our intuition. What our body knows. Or what's obvious before us in a very simple way. Very simple and direct way. Our koans always kind of bring us back to, you know, right here, right now, or right there in the koan story, if that's one of those. But just to be present. And notice the detail. Notice the detail. Because when you're really present, then the detail becomes more clear. We say meticulous, which can kind of like, again, set a high bar, precision. But when you're really with something, and particularly when you're really with yourself, with not much to do, the detail starts to show itself. The detail of being you. The flavor of our particular longing, flavor of our particular, maybe our anguish sometimes, hard. What's going on currently, what kind of runs, our conditioning, all that we just sort of, it's been in the background. If we're not training in this way, it's just in the background pushing us forward. we're being kind of pushed into our life by all our conditioning. But when you sit down and you're not moving forward, you're just sitting still, then it becomes more clear that influences that we have bought into, all the things that kind of run us. It's not bad news, actually. It's not bad news. It's good news to notice it. Sometimes it's really surprising. But people that start out with some meditation practice say, I had no idea my mind was just like always, you know, going like that. Or all the ways I just kind of search around like a hungry dog. I'm always looking for something. Something's missing. I feel I'm not complete. So that's the general, I would say, kind of context of our training. And I just encourage myself and all of us to be kind towards ourselves. Number one, this is, you know, it's not a big, this is not hundreds or thousands of people here. It's a very self-selected group of people that are willing to look a little more closely. They're willing to be patient. Maybe it's a little scary, I don't know. But willing to make effort in a certain way that isn't that hungry dog effort of just, you know, finding something that'll be the solution. No, it's the effort to like be with ourselves very acceptingly, right? Just accept ourselves, accept what comes along and be present to it, right? So we train our attention to like remain. It's called calm abiding, shamatha, calm abiding. So there are all these practices that fall into, you might say, two categories, shamatha and vipassana, calm abiding and insight. Insight comes from having a mind that can stay with the moment or with an experience and be curious and go more deeply into it. That's what we're cultivating. It's what's, you know, so we can see more clearly what's really going on. And that's so, no one can tell us that, and you won't find it in a book. Because nature only makes originals. Every one of us is different. Our experience is different, our background, where we're headed. It's also our gift. You know, the particular struggles or insights or development that we achieve in life, it's a wonderful gift for others. We can give it away. And that touches on this aspect of generosity that I would say generosity and compassion that seems to come along with practicing in this way. Not like we're striving to embody those values like altruism of some kind. It just naturally arises that if we're kind with ourselves, willing to just be with ourselves, come back to it again and again at home, in retreat or whatever, just like return to that. The same old, but patient with that and accepting of what this package is. That's the beginning of really genuine compassion. We can't really care about another person deeply, authentically, unless we have some care and regard and, you know, you might say, respect for ourselves and what we're, how it is for us. That's a compassion piece. Then the generosity, it's interesting. What do we have that we can give away? What do we actually have that's ours? I'm asking that question. What do we have? What can any one of us contribute to this world? And believe me, it's needed.
The only thing I feel like I can ever give away to anybody is my own understanding of myself as it is today.
Well, he's on the mark. That's great. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And that isn't just Zen talk either.
No, no, I
know. I honestly believe that the best I can do for anybody is to figure out my bullshit and tell people how I've done it.
But isn't it interesting that today, that your talk sounds like Zen talk? We had a conversation about, you know, some of the Zen jargon in our stock footage. It gets a little bit kind of, you know, we don't really get the drift of it. But yeah, that's your point is very well taken, and I think that's central to it. What else? What can we give? I mean, can you identify in yourself that there's a wish to contribute in a meaningful way, to actually, we want to offer something. We want to, it feels so good. Pets are great like that, actually. They're always, they're so grateful for whatever, just even, just a, you know, a little pat on the head, or even just being in the room, they're just thrilled. So that we give that. That comes from us. That's what we have. We have ourselves. We give ourselves. But what else? What do we give?
We give a smile.
A smile? True. That's good. Yeah. Yeah. Acceptance. I want to touch on John Craycraft's wonderful inspiration to bring our presence to people that, you know, are being isolated or being sort of somehow sidelined in our society. And there's all kinds of that going on. So that kind of kindness of offering ourselves, offering our time or our presence. And I will say that this Zen Center is the gift of everyone that has worked to make it happen over the years, about 30, 35 years. It's all financed from within the Sangha, you know, people made loans, people made contributions and so on. So we're living in the gift of others. And one give back on our part is to take advantage of it, to do the practice, to come, to engage with it, make it a part of your life, like take what's here. It's really precious. So that kind of give and take, it's a wonderful natural way of being that feels right when you really engage with it. And you find in yourself, in your practice, the understanding that comes or the insight, it leaks out. It's no, you don't have to go out and advertise it. It just leaks out because who you be in the world is being, you might say, it's blooming. Like those flowers in my interview room down there. Blooming. Flowers want to bloom. They don't want to stay like a bud. And neither do we. We want to bloom. And there's all kinds of things that kind of hold us back that we struggle with. But I'm just saying, sit down, be with yourself, be kind to yourself, be patient, and just be there. Just be there. This moment is continually training you specifically in the midst of your experience. Your true master, always right in front of you. Right in front of you. And you're being trained and learning through your life experience. And then you have that to give away. Turns out it's not just for you. So that sense of self-compassion, you know, caring for yourself, and also a sense of generosity, of being, giving it away, giving it away. I did want to just touch on, we had in this community some kind of, I don't know, limited sense of expressing generosity and being actually demonstrate how we value this training or this opportunity or how we value Sangha, demonstrating by, you know, practicing together, being in touch with each other. Also, you know, giving Donna, the teachers, supporting the center. We've got this probably $100,000 project we've got to do for the city to let us keep on. And we're going to do it. And people have begun to really contribute. I hope everyone takes, you know, the opportunity to, you know, give what you can for that. Because that's how this got created. And it's such a good feeling to support something you believe in. And I would say, if you're willing to sit down here and just be quiet and the hours go by, I would say the evidence is in that you believe in this. Maybe you're experiencing something, you know? And you're willing, like some of us, to stay with us for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. Master Jibong, 50 years. You gotta be something about it, that, you know. I mean, he's no dummy, you know, like, he saw deep down value in it. And it comes to us through this beautiful lineage, a lineage of realization that what we do here is not really passed on in books. It's passed on from a teacher to student, you know, a shared experience. Like, I can only share the experience that I have with regard to this practice, but also in our life. We can only share what we've experienced. This is my favorite Einstein quote. Wisdom only comes from experience. Everything else is information. Just information. So I want y'all to, you know, appreciate yourselves, appreciate what you're up to here, that there's a long and venerable lineage and tradition to what we're involved in. And we're very lucky to have this. And whatever change, whatever enrichment comes to you from this, that, you know, just know that even in spite of yourself, it leaks out. It actually affects everyone that you know in life, everyone. You first, and then everyone else. So that was about all I was going to say. I know that we don't quite have the weather we had yesterday, and so Lisa has offered to lead us in some yoga moves, probably standing kind of moves, because we can't all, there's so many of us who can't all lie down, but you can do that? Okay, that's it for now. Thank you all.